Ashenden, W. Somerset Maugham. Chapter 11. Behind the Scenes. When Ashenden was sent to X and looked about him, he could not but see that his situation was equivocal. X was the capital of an important belligerent state, but a state divided against itself. There was a large party antagonistic to the war, and revolution was possible if not imminent. Ashenden was instructed to see what, under the circumstances, could best be done. He was to suggest a policy, and if it was approved by the exalted personages who had sent him, to carry it out. A vast amount of money was put at his disposal. The ambassadors of Great Britain and the United States had been directed to afford him such facilities as were at their command, but Ashenden had been told privately to keep himself to himself. He was not to make difficulties for the official representatives of the two powers by divulging to them facts that it might be inconvenient for them to know. And since it might be necessary for him to give support under cover to a party that was at daggers drawn with that in office, and with which the relations of the United States and Great Britain were extremely cordial, it was just as well that Ashenden should keep his own counsel. The exalted personages did not wish the ambassadors to suffer the affront of discovering that an obscure agent had been sent to work at cross purposes with them. On the other hand, it was thought just as well to have a representative in the opposite camp, who, in the event of a sudden upheaval, would be at hand with adequate funds and in the confidence of the new leaders of the country. But ambassadors are sticklers for their dignity, and they have a keen nose to scent any encroachment on their authority. When Ashenden, on his arrival at X, paid an official call to Sir Herbert Witherspoon, the British ambassador, he was received with a politeness to which no exception could be taken, but with a frigidity that would have sent a little shiver down the spine of a polar bear. Sir Herbert was a diplomat de carrière, and he cultivated the manner of his profession to a degree that filled the observer with admiration. He did not ask Ashenden anything about his mission, because he knew that Ashenden would reply evasively, but he allowed him to see that it was a perfectly foolish one. He talked with assiduous tolerance of the exalted personages who had sent Ashenden to X. He told Ashenden that he had instructions to meet any demands for help that he made, and stated that if Ashenden at any time desired to see him, he had only to say so. "I have received the somewhat singular request to dispatch telegrams for you in a private code which I understand has been given to you, and to hand over to you telegrams in code as they arrive." "I hope they'll be few and far between, sir," answered Ashenden. "I know nothing so tedious as coding and decoding." Sir Herbert paused for an instant. Perhaps that was not quite the answer he expected. He rose. "If you come into the Chancellery, I'll introduce you to the counselor and to the secretary to whom you can take your telegrams." Ashenden followed him out of the room, and after handing him over to the counselor, the ambassador gave him a limp hand to shake. "I hope I shall have the pleasure of seeing you again one of these days," he said, and with a curt nod, left him. Ashenden bore his reception with composure. It was his business to remain in obscurity, and he did not wish any official attentions to attract notice to him. But then, on the afternoon of the same day he made his call at the American Embassy, he discovered why Sir Herbert Witherspoon had shown him so much coldness. The American ambassador was Mr. Wilbur Schaefer. He came from Kansas City, and had been given his post when few suspected that a war was on the point of breaking out, as a reward for political services. He was a big, stout man, no longer young, for his hair was white, but well-preserved and exceedingly robust. He had a square, red face, clean-shaven, with a little snub nose and a determined chin. His face was very mobile, and he twisted it continually into odd and amusing grimaces. It looked as though it were made out of the red India rubber from which they made hot water bottles. He greeted Ashenden with cordiality. He was a hearty fellow. "I suppose you've seen Sir Herbert. I reckon you've got his dander up. What do they mean in Washington and London by telling us to dispatch your code telegrams without knowing what they're all about? You know, they've got no right to do that. Oh, Your Excellency, I think it was only done to save time and trouble, said Ashenden. Well, what is this mission anyway? This, of course, was a question that Ashenden was not prepared to answer, but not thinking it politic to say so, he determined to give a reply from which the ambassador could learn little. He had already made up his mind from the look of him that Mr. Schaefer, though doubtless possessed of the gifts that enable a man to swing a presidential election this way or that, had not, at least nakedly for all men to see, the acuteness that his position perhaps demanded. He gave you the impression of a bluff, good-humored creature who liked good cheer. Ashenden would have been wary when playing poker with him, but where the matter in hand was concerned, felt himself fairly safe. He began to talk in a loose, vague way of the world at large, and before he'd gone far, managed to ask the ambassador his opinion of the general situation. It was the sound of the trumpet to the war horse. Mr. Schaefer made him a speech that lasted without a break for 25 minutes, and when at last he stopped in exhaustion, Ashenden, with warm thanks for his friendly reception, was able to take his leave. Making up his mind to give both the ambassadors a wide berth, he set about his work and presently devised a plan of campaign. But by chance, he was able to do Sir Herbert Witherspoon a good turn, and so was thrown again into contact with him. It had been suggested that Mr. Schaefer was more of a politician than a diplomat, and it was his position, rather than his personality, that gave weight to his opinions. He looked upon the eminence to which he had risen as an opportunity to enjoy the good things of life, and his enthusiasm led him to lengths that his constitution could ill support. His ignorance of foreign affairs would in any case have made his judgment of doubtful value, but his state at meetings of the allied ambassadors so often approached the comatose that he seemed hardly capable of forming a judgment at all. He was known to have succumbed to the fascination of a Swedish lady of undoubted beauty, but of antecedents that from the point of view of a Secret Service agent were suspect. Her relations with Germany were such as to make her sympathy with the Allies dubious. Mr. Schaefer saw her every day, and was certainly much under her influence. Now it was noticed that there was from time to time a leakage of very secret information, and the question arose whether Mr. Schaefer did not in these daily interviews inadvertently say things that were promptly passed on to the headquarters of the enemy. No one could have doubted Mr. Schaefer's honesty and patriotism, but it was permissible to be uncertain of his discretion. It was an awkward matter to deal with, but the concern was as great in Washington as in London and Paris, and Ashenden was instructed to deal with it. He had, of course, not been sent to X without help to do work he was expected to do, and among his assistants was an astute, powerful, and determined man, a Galician Pole, named Herbartus. After consultation with him, it happened by one of those fortunate coincidences that occasionally come about in the Secret Service, that a maid in the service of the Swedish lady fell ill, and in her place, the Countess, for such she was very luckily able to engage an extremely respectable person from the neighborhood of Krakow. The fact that before the war she'd been secretary to an eminent scientist made her doubtless no less competent a housemaid. The result of this was that Ashenden received every 2 or 3 days a neat report upon the goings-on at this charming lady's apartment, and though he learned nothing that could confirm his vague suspicions that had arisen, he learned something else of no little importance. From conversations held at the cozy little tête-à-tête dinners that the Countess gave the ambassador, it appeared that His Excellency was harboring a bitter grievance against his English colleague. He complained that the relations between himself and Sir Herbert were deliberately maintained on a purely official level. In his blunt way, he said he was sick of the frills that damned Britisher put on. He was a he-man and 100% American, and he had no more use for protocol and etiquette than for a snowball in hell. Why didn't they get together, like a couple of regular fellows, and have a good old crack? Blood was thicker than water, he'd say, and they do more towards winning the war by sitting down in their shirt sleeves and talking things out over a bottle of rye than by all their diplomacy and white spats. Now, it was obviously very undesirable that there should not exist between the two ambassadors a perfect cordiality, so Ashington thought it well to ask Sir Herbert whether he might see him. He was ushered into Sir Herbert's library. "Well, Mr. Ashington, what can I do for you? I hope you're quite satisfied with everything. I understand that you've been keeping the telegraph lines busy." Ashington, as he sat down, gave the ambassador a glance. He was beautifully dressed in a perfectly cut tailcoat that fitted his slim figure like a glove. In his black silk tie was a handsome pearl. There was a perfect line in his gray trousers, with their quiet and distinguished stripe, and his neat pointed shoes looked as though he had never worn them before. You could hardly imagine him sitting in his shirt sleeves over a whiskey highball. He was a tall, thin man, with exactly the figure to show off modern clothes, and he sat in his chair rather upright, as though he were sitting for an official portrait. In his cold and uninteresting way, he was really a very handsome fellow. His neat gray hair was parted on one side, his pale face was clean-shaven, he had a delicate, straight nose and gray eyes under his gray eyebrows. His mouth, in youth, might have been sensual and well-shaped, but now it was set to an expression of sarcastic determination, and the lips were pallid. It was the kind of face that suggested centuries of good breeding, but you could not believe it capable of expressing emotion. You would never expect to see it break into the hearty distortion of laughter, but at the most be for a moment frigidly moved by an ironic smile. Ashington was uncommonly nervous. "I'm afraid you'll think I'm meddling in what doesn't concern me, sir. I'm quite prepared to be told to mind my own business." "We'll see. Pray, go on." Ashington told his story, and the ambassador listened attentively. He did not turn his cold gray eyes from Ashington's face, and Ashington knew that his embarrassment was obvious. "How did you find all this out?" "I have means of getting hold of little bits of information that are sometimes useful," said Ashington. "I see." Sir Herbert maintained his steady gaze, but Ashington was surprised to see, on a sudden, in the steely eyes, a little smile. The bleak, supercilious face became for an instant quite attractive. "There's another little bit of information that perhaps you'd be good enough to give me. What does one do to be a regular fellow?" "I'm afraid you can do nothing, Your Excellency," replied Ashington gravely. "I think it's a gift of God." The light vanished from Sir Herbert's eyes, but his manner was slightly more urbane than when Ashington was brought into the room. He rose and held out his hand. "You did quite right to come and tell me this, Mr. Ashington. I've been very remiss. It is inexcusable on my part to offend that inoffensive old gentleman, but I will do my best to repair my error. I will call at the American Embassy this afternoon." "But not in too great state, sir, if I may venture a suggestion." The ambassador's eyes twinkled. Ashton began to think him almost human. "I can do nothing but in state, Mr. Ashton. This is one of the misfortunes of my temperament." Then, as Ashton was leaving, he added, "Oh, by the way, I wonder if you'd care to come to dinner with me tomorrow night? Black tie at 8:15. He didn't wait for Ashenden's assent, but took it for granted, and with a nod of dismissal, sat down once more at his great writing table.